that's an hour secret. Do you promise not to tell? Whoa, whoa, closer.
Hi, I'm Jack Shalom. With the Edward Snowden revelations, the world became acutely aware of the government mass surveillance that we're all subjected to every day. Thank you for your service, Edward Snowden. But of course, the history of surveillance is long, and one of the most prominent practitioners in United States history has been the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Our guest, J. Pat Brown, is one of the founders of the investigative news website MuckRock and the lead editor of a collection of released FBI files targeting American authors entitled Writers Under Surveillance. I'm happy to be talking with J. Pat Brown. Hi, J. Pat.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So that's quite a collection of writers you have here, James Baldwin, Ray Bradbury, Truman Capote, Allen Ginsberg, Ernest Hemingway, Norman Mailer, Susan Sontag, Hannah Arendt, and many others. What exactly do these files in Writers Under Surveillance represent?
All of these files have been released to the Freedom of Information Act. Each one of them had a file for very different reasons. Hannah Arendt had a file opened up on her because she taught a class that encouraged someone's child to go to Europe, and so the parent wrote a letter to the FBI demanding that she be investigated. Allen Ginsberg, they were evaluating whether or not he was dangerous enough to be included on a list of subversives that would need to be arrested in case of martial law was ever declared. Ernest Hemingway, they originally approached him to be the FBI's man in Cuba. So no one story about why all these people were being surveilled, but there is a story that all these people were under surveillance, if that makes sense.
The files are still partly redacted. You can see the blacking out, sometimes absurdly so. In one letter from J. Edgar Hoover to Quentin Reynolds, you can see J. Edgar Hoover's signature, but the J and the Hoover are blacked out, leaving only Edgar. Given that there were things that were redacted, what do you think was the most shocking or surprising thing you came across in these files?
I think it's how personal a lot of these investigations began. I think when you're looking at Gore Vidal's file, for example, he originally opened a file because in one of his plays, he had a line making fun of Hoover. And so as a result, the FBI sent agents to go watch the play and determine whether anyone laughed at the joke. You know, you really see how the line between personal vendettas and sort of quote-unquote national security interests really gets very blurry when you have an organization that is for almost 50 years under the control of one individual.
I also loved reading the little physical descriptions that Ray Bradbury has a scar on the left side of his forehead. But how accurate are they? In one document, I see that W.E.B. Du Bois is 5'6½", and in another, he's shrunk to 5'4". They can't both be right, can they? I mean, it's
well, I can give you an example. There was a big push to try to get John Lennon kicked out of the country before the Republican National Convention, and they ran into difficulty because the photo on file the FBI had was of a different person. It wasn't it wasn't John Lennon. Another example from the Baldwin file, at one point the FBI claims to have interviewed Baldwin's wife, a person who very much does not exist. There's so many examples, just like today in terms of looking at the internet, not all the information was good. And so you see a lot of decisions that were based off of information that was dubious at best. Another example is the FBI once investigated the band Kiss because the FBI director thought that they had caused a riot in Texas when it turns out he had confused them for the Who and the incident, I think in Cincinnati. So, it's funny. I think that's something we really try to highlight is all these sort of incidents and how absurd they are. But even that absurdity is sort of undercut by how powerful these organizations are.
What was the ADEX index, A-D-E-X?
Oh, that was the index of individuals who were determined to be a national security threat. And if there was an event that would cause the United States to go under martial law, this is something that was called Plan C, then every individual on the ADEX would be arrested and immediately. A lot of really fairly prominent people, Jack Shelley, the former mayor of San Francisco, He was on the Ajax and had no way of knowing this until decades afterward when this information came to light.
It's interesting in that it seems that writers as a group had a weapon that the FBI was a little bit scared of. Mm-hmm. You read in a couple of these files that they recommend not interviewing the subject. They didn't want to interview Ginsburg or Susan Sontag because mm-hmm. they were afraid that they would be made fun of and be written about, and that the FBI might get a bad reputation from that.
Absolutely. I think the word you see over and over again is embarrassment. And there was the sense that ridicule was seen as a legitimate weapon, as something that they were deeply scared of. And at the end of the day, it's very much the things that people have in their heads that the FBI is desperate to know and also desperately scared of.
Seems one thing that keeps running through these files as well is Cuba. There's an obsession that Hoover had with Cuba. Can you talk more about that?
I think a big part of that is, you know, again, going back to the personal issue, is Hoover's ambitions to have the FBI be an international intelligence organization. And I think he was deeply threatened by the idea of the CIA and wanted to have a larger role. And having that sort of foot in Cuba and then being able to, like, directly take the fight to communists on their own land, that was he really wanted to make sure that he had that hold, and Cuba was the most direct route to get there.
And it should be mentioned that the obsession with Cuba goes back to before Castro. You have an extensive section on Hemingway mm-hmm. in Cuba, and some of it is kind of humorous and ridiculous, and some of it is very telling about which side the United States was on after World War II.
Absolutely.
I was interested in the story of Ernest Hemingway creating his own, or he thought he was creating his own intelligence network to root out the pro-fascists in the Cuban government after World War II. And of course,
yes.
The FBI and the U.S. ambassador were not so pleased with that.
No, there was absolutely no love lost between Hemingway and the FBI, and you know, he would repeatedly call them a second-rate intelligence agency and would badmouth them to anyone who listened. And the FBI in turn, wrote all these scathing letters about how Hemingway liked to pretend that he was essentially a spy when he was just a man getting drunk on the beach.
How did you obtain these files?
So all of these files have been released through the Freedom of Information Act. A lot of times what has already been publicly released is only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the mm-hmm. total material.
Who oversees the Freedom of Information Act request? What's
every
the
agency
process?
Has their own, every agency has their own FOIA office. The DOJ Office of Information Policy is the one that sort of oversees FOIA requests to the FBI. It's a very mixed record. On one hand, they receive probably the highest volume of all agencies that get requests, thousands probably a day. And they do release, to their credit, hundreds of thousands of pages. However, they're still fighting to keep material redacted that should have been released decades ago. They routinely will claim to have made releases that aren't full releases. And really tragically, because so much of this material hasn't been digitized, there was a flood back in 2011 at the Alexandria Record Center in Virginia, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions of pages of files, particularly on civil rights era, were all destroyed.
Wow. It seems remarkable that such a law wouldn't mandate a neutral agency to oversee such requests. I mean, otherwise you've got conflicts of interest right and left.
There are obviously lots of conflict of interest, as you said. There was relatively recently the office of OGIS, which is the sort of FOIA watchdog, which is or federal FOIA ombudsman, that sort of serves as a neutral arbitrary trader in these kind of cases. But unfortunately, they have extremely limited power in terms of how much they can actually influence agencies. I have had numerous very frustrating phone calls with CIA, for example, where CIA will arbitrarily make up, sort of unilaterally decide that certain requests that we'll just throw out or certain policies it doesn't feel like doing. And to their credit, you'll have these neutral federal watchdogs who will be like, explain to them they can't do that. But then they'll go ahead and just do it anyway, unfortunately.
Yeah. Are there writers, particular writers, who you haven't been able to get the files of that you're interested in?
Well, I feel like relatively recently we filed for Harlan Ellison's file, and we only were able to get 2 pages from the National Records, National Archives, that simply talked about that experimental film school he was associated with in the 70s. But, you know, knowing his connection to the civil rights movement, I'm shocked that there's not more there. And Robert A. Heinlein is also another one of my favorites, and I've been trying to get access to him, especially to the connections to the John Birch Society. There must be something there.
I hope you won't take offense to this, but the files here sometimes read, as you say in the book itself, sometimes they read more as book reports than intelligence gathering. You look at Aldous Huxley's file, and it's basically a summary of his books and ideas. The relative mildness of these files in some way concerns me, because we all know that the FBI ran COINTEL programs and famously tried to get Martin Luther King to commit suicide. And so why this milquetoast kind of release of documents? In some ways, it almost feels like some kind of rehabilitation of the FBI. Oh, you know, they weren't so bad. They were amusing guys who, you know, they were scared to even ask Allen Ginsberg a question because they were afraid he might write about them.
I think it's a great point, and one that I think the FBI has tried to make itself. That, for me, is kind of the most terrifying thing, is that, you know, a lot of the things that we consider, rightly so, invasive surveillance, the FBI sort of has been trying to make the case that we should normalize it, and we should find it sort of acceptable. And I think the fact that we sort of have gotten to a point where we constantly make jokes about, oh, I shouldn't say that in case the FBI is listening, I think that casual acceptance of surveillance is, for me, the deeply worrying thing. Why I feel that we do constantly try to push the banality of a lot of this material, because the extent to it and the extent to which it goes into rooting around in James Baldwin's trash can, you know, it's sort of, there's a humor to it. But at the same time, you know, the punchline is this massive apparatus designed to keep track of people. And, you know,
and on the other hand, what they're not releasing and what you're not reading about is how they planned to murder Fred Hampton and how they went about that.
Exactly. That we had to fight tooth and nail to have access to incredibly boring material. And that's, like, it gets very much the scary thing, where it's like this is what we had to fight for years to find this out. What are we not going to find out for even decades after that? To go back to the civil rights files, most of those are locked in rooms in the National Archives with little letters on them that say don't open until 50 years after everyone involved is dead.
In an important afterword in the book, Trevor Tim says that the FBI had 1,500 informants in 1974, and now there are 15,000 informants. What would getting your file even mean nowadays, when every American is likely the target of numerous mass surveillance projects in digital form and audio form and video form? How would you even get a file on yourself? I mean, you're basically looking at some kind of indexing, Google indexing of a name, right? I mean,
yeah, and
it's not like someone could package it up and give it to you.
Well, I mean, people still do have FBI files composed in them. There are modern equivalents of these same things, and a lot of it is, again, most of it is guilt by association. I maintain an ongoing FBI timeline, and sort of every time we release a file, we add it to this timeline to see who is being investigated and when. Shortly after the Iraq War started, anyone who had criticized the Iraq war, a lot of, you know, were suddenly being designated as terrorist groups. Wow. And it became this sort of infection where if you had one person that was a member of this, an organization that had been designated a terrorist group, had attended a meeting from another organization, all of a sudden that organization gets the label of terrorist, and sort of you have this growing spread around these growing files of, again, like guilt by association. And I think we're quickly becoming one sort of collective file. You know, the idea of individuality itself, I think, is sort of been changed a lot. I think that what we see in these files is the genesis of the modern world in a way that I think is, again, deeply disturbing for its implications of what it means to be sort of cataloged in this way.
As we come to an end here, what do you think is the most important thing we can learn from reading and looking at these files?
For me, the most worrying thing is the idea that this material should be public and it should be part of the conversation. And I feel like people like Hoover sort of, in many ways, sort of overshadow the organization. And you say, oh, J. Edgar Hoover was this personality that he was responsible for all of these bad things they've done, when he was part of an institution that he created and shaped, and these things don't change overnight. The idea that, okay, well, that was Hoover and he was just thin skinned, there's some truth to that, but that doesn't change. The fact that these apparatuses have been created, they don't go away overnight. And the best way to have the government interested in what you're doing is to be critical of the government, which I think is, again, by its self-evidently stifling and terrifying and chilling statement. And I think that's one thing I want people to understand.
Well, thank you, J. Pat. I've been speaking with J. Pat Brown of the investigative news website muckrock.com. He's editor of MIT Press's Writers Under Surveillance. Thanks very much again, J. Pat.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Jack Shalom for Arts Express with host Prairie Miller. Listen to that. You want to know a secret? Do that. Promise not to tell. I do. Whoa, whoa.